Good morning. I'm very glad to be here today and to be able to talk to you about fate and transport of pathogens in on-site wastewater treatment systems. The presentation that I have for you today is taken from a literature review. So this is a review of pretty much everything that we know about how, well, not everything, but most of what we know about how pathogens will behave as they travel through on-site systems. So just an overview of where I'd like to go today. First of all, just briefly talk about the types of pathogens that we are concerned about in wastewater, where they come from, and the diseases that they cause, and then get into talking about their fate and transport in both the septic tank and in the soil treatment unit as those pathogens move through the soil drain field. And then finally, just wrap up with some conclusions, take-home messages, practical applications. So pathogens that we are concerned about in wastewater primarily fall into four groups. These can be protozoa, here's a Giardia protozoa, bacteria, viruses, this is a rotavirus particle, or helminths, also known as the parasitic worms, and this picture here, this is a roundworm egg. In the microscopic world, the pathogens are the bad guys. They're the things that make us sick, that cause disease, and here are some of those diseases that can be of concern from these different waterborne pathogens, and everything from gastroenteritis to hepatitis, Giardia, all of those are some reasons that we are concerned about these pathogens. Certainly a significant public health threat if we don't take care of those in the environment. Okay, so we have our picture here of a household that is on an on-site system. Wastewater moves out of that household to the septic tank, to the drain field, and anything that is not attenuated then in that system can definitely enter groundwater and move potentially to a public drinking water well. And the U.S. Centers for Disease Control says that the five most common disease outbreaks associated with this type of scenario are hepatitis A, Giardia, Shigella. Shigella is a severe bacterial gastroenteritis infection. E. coli and Salmonella. So those are the big five right there that we're concerned about from sewage-contaminated water. So to talk about the fate and transport of these things in on-site systems, we really need to characterize the different types of pathogens because their sizes and their shapes and their morphologies, all of those things greatly affect how they behave in the environment. So let's look first at bacteria. These are single-celled organisms that range in size from about 0.2 to 2 microns, and they may oftentimes have charged surfaces that can be either negative or positive charges associated with them. Viruses, on the other hand, are simply a nucleic acid, and that can be either DNA or RNA, and it is surrounded by a protective protein coating. And look how much smaller they are than the bacteria. They range in size from 20 to 300 nanometers, so a couple of orders of magnitude smaller than the bacteria. And these also often have charged surfaces associated with them. And in that picture that I have here below, right here, this larger thing right here is a bacterial cell, and these right here are all individual virus particles. So I just put that there so that you can visualize the size difference between your bacteria and your viruses. And this will have important implications for how they behave in the soil, those differences in sizes, as well as the fact that they can develop positive or negative charges associated with them. This just characterizes protozoa, which are single-celled animals, and their life cycle involves a cyst or an oocyst. And so let's suppose we have a person that's infected with a Giardia protozoan, this person is infected. Both the animal and the cyst part of that life cycle can be shed in the feces from this infected individual, but the animal doesn't live in the environment. But the cyst can survive for months in the environment, so it's the cyst that we're concerned about. And these cysts, then, if they make their way to groundwater and first somebody drinks that, then the infection cycle begins all over again. So that's why we're worried about those cysts. They are much larger than bacteria. They range in size from 10 to 100 microns in diameter. But they are very persistent in wastewater. Even in the municipal wastewater treatment plants, they're hard to get rid of because they resist disinfection. Giardia is particularly known to be hard to get rid of. And this just characterizes our helminths, or our parasitic worms that can lodge themselves in the intestinal tract. And it's their eggs, or their ova, that are shed in the feces. And so in our case, it's the eggs that we're concerned about. These eggs, like the protozoan cysts, have thick outer coatings that make them very resistant to environmental changes so they can survive very long periods of time in the environment. And in this picture here, I show a couple of those helminth ova. And you can see in many cases this protective outer coating that makes them so persistent. Okay, the source of pathogens in wastewater, and probably don't need to tell you where pathogens come from in wastewater, but they come primarily, of course, from body waste. And these are some numbers of some typical pathogen counts in just 1 gram of human feces. And you can see that just 1 gram of human feces can have trillions of pathogenic organisms in it. Just an important thing to point out from this table, with the exception of the fecal coliform bacteria, everything here on this list is only present in wastewater when it's coming from a household that has an infected individual. These pathogens are not normally in the waste stream unless there is a case of infection. The fecal coliform, however, are natural fauna of our intestinal system, so they are always present. A couple other minor sources of pathogens in wastewater. Anywhere in this house where you have water or wastewater originating, you can get pathogens. Most of it is, of course, coming from fecal material, but we can also have some coming from these minor sources. Sputum, that stuff we cough up when we've had a cold, vomit, bath, shower water, clothing, those sorts of things. Okay, so here is our on-site system. We want to make sure that we protect the groundwater from pathogens entering that groundwater so that we can protect public drinking water, private drinking water wells at some point down the path. So how do we do that? Where are our chances to do that? Well, we can do that in the septic tank by simply pathogens dying off, or we can do it in the septic tank by pathogens settling to the bottom. We can also have that occur in the soil. Again, in the soil, these pathogens can just die off. They just don't perhaps live very long there. They can be filtered out if they move down through the soil. Or they can also be attenuated by adsorption to charged soil surfaces, because remember, our bacteria and viruses do have charged surfaces associated with them, so they can be adsorbed to soil particles. Just first want to look at die-off in the septic tank. And this, again, is taken as from a literature review, so the ranges that we're looking at here for die-off in the septic tank, the ranges are about 50 to 95% for bacteria, less than that, considerably less than that for viruses, and virtually no die-off is reported in the literature for our helminths or our protozoan cysts. And remember, that's because they have that protective outer coating, and they can survive for long periods. And I just put an example here of how that's the case for our helminth ova. We're looking at inactivation for these things only when temperature is above 40 degrees C and moisture is below 5%. So it's not going to happen in your septic tanks. It's very hard to get rid of those. And they can also remain viable in septage or the solid materials associated in that wastewater for years. The next phase that could happen in the septic tank is settling out. Now, this is the septic tank. As you go from your raw wastewater to your septic tank effluent, the retention time there is about 2 to 3 days. So during that retention time, you can get a settling out pretty well of your helminth ova because they are large, much larger than your other pathogens here. You can get some settling of your protozoan cyst, a little bit of your bacteria, but you will not get settling of the viruses in the septic tank because they are much too small. Because of that, they are notoriously persistent in the septic tank. And this table, the take-home point here is that only helminth ova are adequately removed in the septic tanks, and everything else can pretty well continue to move on past and through it. And this table shows that point very well. We're looking at pathogen counts in raw wastewater, pathogen counts in the septic tank effluent, and you can see that there's, in some cases, a little bit of reduction, but there are still many, many orders of magnitude of numbers of pathogens in the septic tank effluent. So what's coming out has not been adequately reduced. And a really good point here, too, is this table showing the infectious dose of these pathogens. And sometimes all it takes is just one organism to make you sick. And all it takes is that one organism, but the septic tank effluent can still contain thousands or millions of those organisms. So what takes place in the soil then becomes really important. And this is where it gets good. As a soil scientist, here's the good story about the pathogen fate in soils. Just start off, first of all, they can die in the soil. There's a well-established inverse relationship between pathogen survival and temperature. So we see higher survival in cold temperatures. And here's table that shows this very well. This is some recent work that was looking at E. coli. This solid line shows soil temperature. These are at different depths of E. coli leaching from the soil. Leaching very high in the winter time when temperatures are cold because the pathogens are surviving in that cold temperature. But once we get to the summer, no pathogen leaching, no E. coli leaching here because it's very warm in the summer. So we certainly see some important implications for if you are in a temperate environment and you have these cold and these hot times, you will see definitely very different patterns in your pathogen die-off. Similar things are observed for viruses and Giardia, and I just put some examples here showing, for example, a virus study where they're surviving less than 12 days at 37 degrees C, but you get it down to 4 degrees C, and these things can survive for 180 days. So there's, again, that inverse relationship between temperature and die-off. There have also been some studies that show that the optimal survival pH for these pathogens is around 6 to 7, though not a lot of work done on that. And then another thing that can affect survival is organic matter. And we generally see in the literature that high organic matter soils encourage pathogen survival because the organic matter can give protective microsites for those pathogens and so that they are not scavenged by the native soil fauna. So those pathogens survive longer when there's lots of organic matter. Okay, soil moisture can also affect pathogen die-off, but the results from that are variable. A lot of studies show that the drier you get, the more pathogens you kill off, and this is a very early study on viruses showing survival in 180 days in saturated soil, but no infectivity in dry soil here meaning at wilting point. However, recently, though, there's been a lot of work done on the idea of what happens after you re-wet the soil. And recently you see here on the right side an example of Salmonella surviving 46 days after desiccation, and then when the soil was re-wetted, we saw bacterial regrowth again. And this is because of something that's called when those bacteria are viable but non-culturable. So in other words, when environmental conditions are adverse to their survival, they can go into a state of very low metabolic activity. They are still viable. They can still be means of infection, but they are not culturable. So if we do a study on bacteria in these soils and we use a classical microbiological media culture growth method, we would not culture these bacteria. We would not be able to detect them in the culture. We would think that they were gone, but they were still there. They were just not culturable, and they're still viable. And when we re-wet those soils, they then can become a means of infection again. So a lot of work still to be done there, but we need to determine which bacteria will do this and under what conditions. Salmonella is known, E. coli as well is known to do that. Okay, so if we can't kill them off in the soil, what's the next thing we can do? We can filter them through the soil. And of course, this is just entrapment of those pathogens in pore spaces smaller than the pathogen. It's really effective for our helminths and our protozoan cysts because they're large. Bacteria to a little bit, but absolutely not at all for our viruses. They're just too small. One of the things that's been shown to really affect this is the size and shape, size of course, but shape as well of the pathogens. And I've put some pictures here to illustrate a few examples. These are bacteria that are long and rod-shaped, but over here we have, of course, the more spherical-shaped bacteria. These long rod-shaped ones can very easily make their way through this kind of tortuous path of a water molecule. It's just they can just sort of water slide down through that path, and they are not filtered out very effectively, whereas the more spherical pathogens, they can get lodged easier in that tortuous path of the water molecule. So they can be filtered out much easier. And so here we see that filtering, of course, is going to be very specific to the type of pathogen that we're dealing with. Filtering can also be affected by the drainage class of your soil. And then this is a study I found on looking at just a couple of different types of soil. I labeled just the extreme cases here. This extreme case of not a lot of E. coli leaching. This is the extreme case of lots of E. coli leaching. And this had a drainage class of very well drained. This one had a drainage class of poorly drained. So in this case, we see the well-drained soil, not a lot of leaching of E. coli. So therefore, we assume a lot of filtering out of E. coli because we have matrix flow dominating. It's slow. We're allowing time for filtering to take place. However, in this poorly drained soil where saturated conditions take over, we get preferential flow, we're bypassing we have bypass flow going on, so reduced chances for filtering in this case. And so a very important take-home point here is this need for well-drained, unsaturated conditions. Okay, as you may know, in on-site systems, we can also develop what's called the biomat. It's that layer of biological growth and residue that develops just at the interface between the drainage lines and the soil surface of the soil matrix, underlying soil matrix. These can be very effective in filtering out pathogens. In some of the cases, up to 99% removal of our bacteria and protozoa from these biomats, viruses to a lesser extent. But it's important that biomat be developed properly. And a good thing to remember here is that biomats take time to develop. So if you have a new system, a very new system where that biomat is not developed yet, you're not going to see this kind of extensive filtering. Okay, so if we don't kill them off, we don't filter them out, what's the next thing we can do? We can adsorb them to soil surfaces. This is a hematite grain with some bacteria adsorbed to it. And bacteria and viruses can sorb to soil surfaces because of their charges that can be associated with them. This is especially important for viruses because they are too small to filter out, they're too small to settle out. So if we're going to stop their transport in the soil environment, we really need adsorption of these things. And another thing to remember about that, though, is that adsorption does not necessarily mean die-off. And in many cases, actually, adsorption of virus particles to the soil can increase their survival because it gives them a nice, safe place to be. So, and then later on, they can then desorb and still be infectious. And so that's an important thing to remember, especially if you have an environment where you might have a high rainfall after a long dry spell, then a lot of those adsorbed viruses can be removed. And I wanted to just show you an example of why viruses are able to sorb to soil surfaces. Here's a virus particle. You see this protective outer protein coating that they have. These things often have negative charges associated with them, but it depends on the type of virus that we're dealing with. But most of the time, they do have negative charges, and so because of that, they can sorb to positive charge sites in the soil. And it varies from organism to organism, but there are some generalities, and these are that adsorption increases with decreased pH because you're developing positive charge, pH-dependent positive charge sites on your soil. Increased ionic strength will increase adsorption, and this has to do with double layer theory. As you increase that ionic strength, you decrease the size of that double layer that's associated with your soil surfaces, and that way you reduce the size, reduce the distance between your virus particle and the charged soil surface. You can get increased adsorption. Decreased soluble organic matter will increase adsorption because organic matter will compete for those sorption sites. And our iron oxide minerals will also increase adsorption because they are the ones that often have their charges associated with them. And again, I've underlined it here, unsaturated flow, very important for increasing adsorption because it gives time, the necessary time that we need for those adsorption processes to be carried out. This just quickly shows the influence of ionic strength on virus adsorption from some very early work. Quickly here, just to point out, ionic strength is high here, and so virus penetration is to about 40 centimeters, but here where ionic strength is low, we can get only six times that depth of penetration of our virus particles, presumably because of much less adsorption at this lower ionic strength. Here's showing the effect of flow on virus attenuation, again, presumably because of adsorption. And here with the unsaturated flow, we get viruses down to about 40 centimeter depth, but we get about four times that under saturated flow conditions, again, because we're just not allowing the time necessary for that adsorption process to take place. Okay, so really, with all of these processes that we have, die-off, bacterial filtering, adsorption, all of these processes can remove a great deal of our pathogens in our on-site systems, but we still have some vulnerable environments where we are going to be especially concerned about. And I listed just a few of those here. Those are the ones that have porous soils, where things can move through very quickly, where we have fractured bedrock or karst topography because we get these channels and conduits for rapid transport, and also anywhere where we have shallow water tables. And just some case studies that sort of point that out. This first one here, we're looking at a case where we had fractured dolomite. So we had these instances for rapid transport of these particles through the on-site system. In other cases here, we're looking at sandy soils with shallow water tables or fractured limestone. All these cases where we had documented disease outbreaks because of these vulnerable environments. So the point that we really need to do is to be concerned about these vulnerable environments. Okay, so just a take-home message here again. Remember that this unsaturated zone is so important because it provides opportunity for filtering and adsorption and good contact. And I'll move on. If we are in a vulnerable environment, there are some alternatives that we can do to improve pathogen attenuation. We've already talked about some of these today. One of these is our low-pressure dosing, which just allows us to have a more controlled movement of the effluent through the soil, therefore allowing for extenuated unsaturated flow conditions. We can also use a mound system to just provide us more opportunity again for unsaturated flow. Or we can run our effluent through some sort of filtering system. In this case, I've illustrated peat. Peat is found to be very effective in pathogen removal, and this would have to be added to a conventional system, but we can do that. Finally, we can do chlorination or UV light disinfection to remove pathogens. These would, again, have to be added to a conventional system, and there's some cost to the homeowners. And we have found in the literature time and time again that unless the homeowners keep up the maintenance on these things, they really don't work at all. So we do need to keep up maintenance, or it's pretty much no good in pathogen removal for us. So just in summary, again, time and time again, the message is that we need to maintain that unsaturated soil so that we can have die-off, settling, adsorption of these pathogens in the soil treatment unit, and that's very important. Removal is site-specific, but in our more sensitive aquifers and when soil conditions are not adequate, we can use some of those alternative systems and see very good pathogen removal. That is it, and I will thank you for your time today. Thanks.